This is CliffCentral.com.
Sia was quite rude about this song, but I love Annie Lennox. It's called Walking on Broken Glass. How old is that? That's probably about 20 or 30 years old.
Hey, rephrase.
Way longer than that.
I wasn't rude. I was complimentary in a different way.
Nah. So that was 1992. Sure.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Walking on Broken Glass. Great. The music video had John Malkovich in it.
Oh, the actor.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very quirky, strange man.
Such a strange man.
Even the Being John Malkovich movie, it says it all.
Yeah, he was great. All right, so loads of things that are on our minds this morning. If you've got something in your mind you want to share with us, maybe it'll take conversation in a different direction. You can call us on 0861-555-189. You can message us at 079-748-2090. It pitches up right on the screen in front of me. For example, I mean, there's so many messages we've got this morning. Someone says, sucking on broken ass is a much better song than that. suck it on
broken ass.
Thanks. I'll never listen to it the same again.
We get brilliant and then we get downright ridiculously stupid stuff. Michelle says, sorry, Leanne, you can't. You can pick your nose, but you can't pick your family. Mm. Your uncle is having a challenge.
Yeah.
It's having a challenge.
It might be a lifetime challenge, but yeah.
Yeah. All right, so loads of things we can get to this morning. First thing I want to talk about is Sia Khaleesi's wife, Rachel. Sia Sangweni here in the studio has found a clip of her. She's kind of losing her mind. You know, I got to say that there's some things that are just best kept in the house.
Off social media.
Yeah. You're really just creating a world of unnecessary pain for yourself. Because unfortunately, most people are not nice. And a lot of people are not going to express sympathy for you when you're undergoing some kind of personal challenge. Most people would love to take the chance to denigrate you, make fun of you, ridicule you, especially if you are in a better position than them, because it makes them feel better. It's called Schadenfreude. So Sia Khaleesi's wife, Rachel, is getting praise from a few people, but she's also getting a lot of criticism from people for saying to other women who are DMing her husband that they must stop.
Yeah, it all started yesterday. She was slamming one woman in particular for sliding into her husband's DMs on Instagram. And this is someone who Sia was already engaging with. And Rachel was able to find a photo that this woman sent to see of her, like in bikini, in a bikini bottom, but more showing her ass to Sia. And also then through her investigation, Rachel found this lady's name and her Facebook account and screenshot that and uploaded it onto Instagram as well. Found out where this lady trains, the gym at which she trains, to the point where this lady actually ended up blocking Rachel, changed her Instagram handle, and Rachel it just kept on going and going and going. Hey guys, do you know her new handle?
Oh, no.
Do you know where she works? And it just seems
it turns into doxing. It gets very ugly very quickly. I sometimes have to either delete whole threads on my Facebook or Twitter or Instagram. I don't do it that much anymore, but I used to. The minute people get personal.
Yeah,
I don't want to be involved.
It took us away from the root issue that she was originally bringing up to now looking at Rachel going, are you okay? Like, what's...
Well, so if you and your husband are so happy and you trust each other and clearly you have access to his DMs, then none of these women are a threat. But here, let's listen to her in her own words and then we can decide where we go from here, because this is going to open up a can of worms for a lot of other people in relationships where DMs that they might or might not see are involved.
My face is so red because I'm so angry. But I just want to finish off this situation saying this. That the days of women having to take shit and deal with shit and do nothing about it are over.
She doesn't sound
okay. She sounds cross.
Yeah.
You know, she says, my face is so red. because I'm so angry. I get it for someone in her position, but also this is not an isolated incident. Rachel is known to go onto social media and attack any sort of female attention that Sia Khaleesi gets. A while ago, someone had posted on Twitter saying like, oh, Sia Khaleesi is my type of man.
Yeah.
And Rachel responded to that saying, he is not a type. He is my husband and the father of my kids. You know, so she's always on an attack when it comes to any sort of woman who
someone's comes around. Someone's got to sit her down and say, listen, you know what, honey? You're married to this dude who happens to now be the captain of the Springboks. He's going to get a lot of attention. You've got to decide what's worth your energy and what isn't.
Yeah, someone's saying he's my type of guy. And
that person's not threatening your marriage.
Someone sending a saucy pic. Did he reply to the pic?
Well, no, we haven't heard anything from Sia right now because I think he's in New Zealand.
I'm saying on the DMs, did he reply?
I don't know about that.
Mm. Yeah, and also she's looking at his DMs. Does that mean she has his login? Look, I don't know. Men can be a bit silly sometimes. Let me go into relationship story.
Another help desk. Okay.
I was given my partner's Twitter login details because he was having a challenge with his phone and trying to tweet something, and so gave me the login so that I could upload stuff for him.
And what did you find?
And he quite liked the ease of me doing this, and every now and then would say, please tweet something on my behalf. Please tweet blah, blah, blah. So he knew very well that I had his login details.
Right.
We were sleeping in separate rooms at the time because we now realize from my apnea stories that I snored like a donkey.
Yeah.
And sleeping in separate rooms,
You mean he wasn't charmed by that?
No. Oh. He didn't find it a turn on. I don't know why. And I was reading my tweets before I went to sleep. And because I was signed on as him as well, because you can be signed on two accounts at the same time or more, I received a DM alert.
Yes.
And I realized that it was to his account.
Okay. And what was it?
Oh, why am I already slightly fuming now? I'm
pissed. It was a photograph of a girl, just her face. But she had on those stupid, when the screen turned your face into a cat, Snapchat things.
Oh, right. Snapchat filter.
Yeah, she had on one of these stupid things, and she was trying to look like a sexy Manx in the picture. And I saw this arrive in the DMs of my boyfriend, and I thought, I wonder, I'm literally one door away from him. Mm. We're sharing a wall, and our doors are closed. And I thought, I'm going to let this ride out, because I already had so many suspicions at the time, and I'd bust him with so many things before. So I thought, let me just let this ride out and see where it goes. Obviously, even as I'm speaking about it now, my hands are sweating. Obviously, it was really difficult to just sit there. And he replied something like, you know, one of these sort of sexual sounds. And at this point, I knew what was happening next door in the bed. I knew that there was obviously self-pleasuring going on.
Good Lord. Could you hear it?
No, I couldn't hear it. But I just knew the nature of this person led me to believe, because he'd done this sort of thing before, that that's what he was doing. And so I let it ride out, and I thought, well, I'll give him his space because I don't want to walk in seeing that. And I waited a few minutes, and then I opened the door and said, are you quite done? And he kind of fumbled around. The light was already off. Fumbled around, turned on his bedside light. And he was like, what are you talking about? I was like, I've just seen everything that happened on Twitter, on DM. What? I did nothing. I said, look at my phone. I can see the images right here. Jesus. I can see the conversation. He was still denying it. Obviously, at this point, I start getting really angry. We are now standing upright. We're no longer in the bedroom. And it was then the blame was turned to me about how I was being nosy.
Oh, okay. That's the main point. Sure.
How I cannot keep my nose out of anyone's business, etc. And threats were made, etc. And that's it always ended ugly. But that's how it went.
just disgusting.
Do you think?
Yeah, I think it is disgusting. I'm with Sia. Look, there are guys who who get a thrill out of two-timing.
Yeah, there's some who, that's the only way they can go through a relationship is if they're two-timing.
I don't understand it because, and I've cheated once in my life and I wasn't proud of it. I think you've got to make your decision. Like if you're a real, and I'm talking to men here, so I'm talking to the male partner in any situation. And if they're two males or if they're no males, you know what I mean by that. If you're going to be a real man, again, to refer to kind of gender-based language, you've got to make your call. You cannot have both and expect me to have respect for you. Ugh. And forget about my respect. How about the women that you're two-timing? If you are in a relationship with someone you care about, maybe you even have kids together, maybe you're married, I don't know. Either that has to be the priority, or there's such love for the other girl, the other person, that you must be with them. But you have to make a call, because while you're juggling both, you are doing tremendous harm, not only to both of those people, but to yourself. So I have respect for someone who goes, you know what, honey, I've fallen in love with someone else. I've got to be with her. Can't help myself. I think about her all the time. I apologize for hurting you, but I'm out. As much as that's painful and that's awful and that's, at least it's honest. And you get out and you'll deal with the consequences. They're going to be horrible consequences, especially if it involves children and, you know, the divorce.
Assets
and all of that stuff. It's going to be very ugly. But if you feel your heart is pulling you to another person and you just know you can't live without them, then go with them and see what happens and deal with what happens. Or say to the other woman or the other guy or whoever it is, whatever your relationship situation is, say to them, listen, as much as I love you, I can't do this. I have responsibilities. I've committed. I'm in a relationship. I'm married. I have children. I have work or whatever it is that I do with this person. I can't be with you. I'm going to have to cut you loose. And say to the person that you're not with, I'm going to cut you loose.
And the same works for if you realize you just can't be faithful, then you need to be single.
Well,
I think
absolutely, or not in a monogamous relationship, because isn't that the entire premise of being in a relationship or any sort of commitment like a marriage? It is saying to someone, despite it all, I choose you.
Or, Sia, it may
be faithful to
the
you.
Agreement may be different.
Agreement
of the relationship.
Agreement? Great.
Yes.
But in most cases, there isn't this highfalutin, well thought out agreement.
In most cases, it's
and
human nature to become jealous if there is another person involved in the relationship. If you don't get jealous and you think it works for you, then that's another relationship scenario.
See, so this is why, as much as we bring up Rachel Colisi as the subject matter here, I get her response to a certain extent. It's a very emotional response, and we know the stereotype when it comes to sports stars.
And who's
on
gonna,
top of the fact the stereotype of men?
Yeah, who's going to have a problem with a woman defending her territory and claiming her man? And you know what? From that point of view, I can not fault her at all.
My initial thought was, how can she go public with this? Isn't it a personal issue? But I actually feel I feel quite liberated by her.
I think a lot of
because,
women would.
Because, you know, when it happens to you, you actually feel ashamed and you blame yourself. That's the first reaction as a woman.
Really?
Whether or not you move on from that is another story. Yeah.
That's interesting.
In what way?
Well, you won't blame yourself for it, but you'll feel embarrassed to admit to other people that this is going on. Because
you don't want
them to think that your relationship's shit.
Okay.
Especially when you've made big moves, like you've moved to another city or you've got married or you've done something big and now this person's cheating on you. For you to admit that it's shitty is very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I take my hat off to her to be able to say in public and of another public figure.
Well, Kelly agrees with you. She says, no, guys, I don't think it's weird for Rachel to be pissed off. I would bitch slap any girl who came on to my husband. That doesn't mean I don't trust him, But the bitch is better stay in line.
Yeah. Do you know, I think her anger is warranted. I think the way she's going about it, though, isn't the best. You know, they often say it's not what... they call you that matters. It's what you answer to that does. And I think you can't put so much energy into that. You know, you end up seeming like the loose cannon here.
Then there's the golden question, and it's also what was raised by somebody who commented on the tweet. Why is Rachel asking the public about her husband's DMs and not Sia himself?
Yeah, but again, you can't. Yeah. You don't know. You don't know what they're.
She may have very well have had a long conversation about it.
Maybe before she went online, she spoke to him.
Your yes says.
Maybe he said he didn't care, and that's what he made her cross.
Ours Rachel Sio is lucky he's in New Zealand.
Ooh. So what would you do? All right, what would you
really,
do?
Sia?
So let's say you're in a relationship.
All right, I love your commitment.
Sia Sangweni is in a relationship with somebody, and this person then gets DMs from a whole lot of other people hitting on them. Thirsty DMs.
Oof.
What do you do? And you find out because you've got the logins.
You see, it depends what. So let's think.
Let's say, okay, I'll start the scenario.
Yeah.
First scenario, somebody's just, you know, like an admirer. They say, oh, you know, I saw you in town last Thursday, and you're just a beautiful human being.
Is it Sia Kolisi who I'm in a relationship or just like Joe Soap?
Joe Soap
has no. Oh, Joe Soap, I hope you work in a freaking cubicle at the office, because I will motherfucking send screenshots of your DMs to every single printer in the office, just like ream after ream of paper of all of your screenshots. I will make sure on Monday morning when you walk into the boardroom for that presentation and you plug your laptop in, somehow I've spoken to IT to rather pop up all of your DMs instead of your PowerPoint presentation. Oh, your life is messed.
So you think it's fair to say to a person upon entering a relationship when you've decided you want to be officially dating, you think it's fair to say, if you cheat on me, I will ruin your life?
For me personally, it is an instant deal breaker. And maybe I am bruised because it's happened so personally in my circles, you know, within family, you know, my sisters have been cheated on, you know, I've seen the impact of it. Mm. Right. And it is quite a selfish thing to do. Yes, you might say, oh no, well, I can't help it and it's a thrill for me. But you have no idea what you're doing to the person, as you've rightfully said. Mm. You know, you take it on. You think, what did I do wrong? Am I not attractive anymore? Your kids will never be the same anymore, because now they see this dynamic of their parents not loving or being hostile to each other around the house. You know, your family's torn apart. It is such a selfish thing to do, to cheat, in my opinion. Mm. And more especially, the premise of a relationship being the commitment, and you've gone against that. Oh, you know, if I was Rachel, screw getting mad at that chick. I will find that chick's parents, befriend the parents of the chick. So that Sia next time will come over to the side chick's house and find me sipping tea with the parents. Like, oh, hey.
Do you know how comforting it must be?
I want to punch someone in the throat.
See, yeah, no, I like this. There's loyalty there.
You know how comforting it must be to be in a relationship where you know that that person will never cheat on you? I don't know what that's like.
I think that's sad.
It's fucking sad.
Oh. Well, this is the difficulty of human relations. It really is. It's just human relations are so complicated. I don't know the answers.
Yeah.
I don't know the answers.
And I don't know if it's better to just stay away from them.
Well, then you put your heart behind an iron wall. I don't know that that's healthy.
No, if it comes along, it comes along, but... To look for it.
Without risk, there isn't a reward. And we all know how good it feels to be loved and to love.
Yeah.
But we also know that there is no more painful thing than to have that love thrown against a wall.
Especially when you're of the belief that nothing lasts forever.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's absolutely true.
It's a factual statement.
Objectively true that nothing lasts. So you've got to get over yourself. If you think that things are going to last forever, you're just childish. All right.
Just one closing thing on this Rachel Khaleesi thing. Whatever everyone's saying about it. I think the hardest part is if she decides that they want to work it out, is she, you know, it's still under the public eye.
Yeah, she's, once you go public, you can never pull that back. You can never say, okay, now it's time for you guys to step away. You've enjoined the public into your discussion.
Yeah.
Now they're going to be part of it from here on.
And that's the other thing as well. And, you know, telling friends or family about a fight that you've had or something that you've discovered in your relationship, they're going to hate the person forever. You've got to realize that if you want to try and work things out, you'd best not tell anyone.
Yeah, try and figure it out yourself first. Michelle says, guys, if your partner responds to any of the social media DMs, there's already a problem in your relationship. If you're secure in your relationship, the DMs will not matter. Yeah, Michelle, I think that's a good point, but it's also kind of, it's very superficial because sometimes the stuff gets a little more complicated. And it depends on what kind of DMs are being sent and also whether things are being acknowledged or whether they're not. Whether people are being blocked or they're not. Mm-hmm. There's so many complicated rules around this. And we're only, as creatures of social media, we're only 10, 15 years into this. We're brand new. We haven't even got out of our adolescence in terms of understanding social media. We're all, everyone on earth is still a social media teenager.
If you think about the things that you tweeted when you first joined Twitter compared to now, you see
how
much we've grown.
Well, here are a couple of other things, and people are talking about a lot of things. So Cyril Ramaphosa apparently yesterday on his train delay said, oh, all these problems in the country, most especially Eskom, these are our collective fault. And I saw one of the journalists who regularly joins us on the Burning Platform, Ivo Fechter, said, no, Mr. President, it really isn't. I wasn't on the board of Eskom. I wasn't politically involved in Eskom. It's your problem. It's your fault. You were there, and it's your dereliction of duty that got us to this place. And, you know, Cyril seems to be surprised by everything. Like, oh, the Guptas? Oh, the Basasa? Oh, Eskom? Cyril was there the whole time. And he's got to stop thinking that we're so stupid that we're just going to forgive him for pretending that he wasn't involved in some of these important
decisions. He's been an electricity user for a long time.
Exactly. It's outrageous that the president of the country thinks that all of us are to blame for something that is uniquely his ANC's fault. I'm sorry, Mr. President. Ivo Fechter is spot on. You are full of shit if you think that the rest of South Africa deserves the blame for what's happened at Eskom. Mm. We all pay our electricity every month, and it keeps going up. And if we don't pay it, we get our power cut off. Mm. You don't know about this because you travel in blue light brigades, you live in state housing, you probably have generators you didn't even pay for that are backing up your power everywhere you go.
You don't even know when the power's
out. You have no idea.
Up until you get onto a train you experience what the common person does.
Our president was delayed for hours yesterday on a train.
It was just over 3 hours.
Yeah.
What are the chances? You know, sometimes
good.
The way things work.
I love when politicians actually feel what ordinary people of this country feel. And I suppose the next big surprise from Cyril is going to be, what? Four in every 10 South Africans doesn't have a job?
He's going to be when horrible. He's recalled. That will be his epiphany when he's recalled.
Kolani on the messages this morning wants to take me on. Gareth, you're a hypocrite, calling out the egg boy instead of the Australian senator who actually made racist remarks about Muslims. That was really appalling. Well, Kolani, we dealt with this yesterday on the show. They're two separate situations. First of all, you cannot conflate what a senator says. He was not the gunman. He did not go into the mosque and shoot a whole bunch of innocent people. He is not the killer. You can't make him seem like the killer. That's called conflation, and it means your brain isn't working properly. So we separate the two issues. First of all, there is the appalling situation of people being shot in a mosque, which I've said already, and I'll say again, is comparable to me to that ugly Tree of Life massacre, which was also a white supremacist. In America this time, it was a synagogue, it was Jewish people, and the same ugliness ensued. In this case, it was Muslims, it was in a mosque, it was in New Zealand, but it was also a white supremacist. Now, I don't even know what Fraser's comments on this were, and it's immaterial to me, because words shouldn't lead to violence. Now, as much as violence of an egg being cracked in someone's head is not the same as violence of being punched in the face or being knifed or being shot, I don't think that you beget good things by becoming violent. I don't think it helps anyone. If you disagree with a senator because he's made whatever statements you say, racist remarks, then disagree with him. Argue with him. Explain to him why his remarks are unacceptable. But cracking an egg on his head when you're a 17-year-old is just you being trapped in the rebellious child stage of your development.
Mm-hmm.
And you need to, and if you're 17, that's acceptable behavior, but then you're going to have to reap the consequences of that by being punched in the face. That's what happens to people who crack eggs on adult men's heads. They get punched in the face because most men are not going to tolerate that kind of thing. A real man is going to stand up for himself. He doesn't wait to have eggs cracked on his head by teenagers. And disrespectful teenagers need to be put in their place. That's how the world works. So I'm separating.
Otherwise, we'd waste a lot of eggs if the world worked any differently.
Who would ever have a good egg for breakfast if we were doing this?
Bunch of bad eggs.
So, Kolani, we need to separate the two issues. You're conflating them. It's dangerous. You're mixing up two things. You're making a nothing burger out of something that the two separate stories.
Nobody wants a nothing burger.
No one wants a nothing burger. So first of all, there's the mosque situation, which everyone in their right minds and everyone who has any shred of moral decency ought to decry as a hideous, violent, ugly, nasty hate crime that besmirches the reputation of all human beings. And then we have to look at the senator and the situation with the kid with the egg as a separate matter. And even though the senator might have said something about the mosque, that does not mean the senator was the gunman and deserved the egging, or that someone who says something racist automatically needs to have violence perpetrated upon them, because that leads to more violence. It's a stupid point of view. So I hope I've addressed that for you decently.
Sounded like a fair explanation.
Sure. Apparently 90% of the city of Beira has been destroyed by that cyclone. 90% of it. It's a huge city. 340,000 Swiss francs have just been released by the IFRC from their Disaster Relief Emergency Fund, which will go to the initial response effort in Mozambique. Isn't that absolutely incredible? 90% of a city taken out by this cyclone is just frightening, right?
Oof, that's going to take them a long time to recover.
Maybe never.
Yeah. There are a couple of other things that are in the news that we need to look at this morning. First of all, what has President Ramaphosa's comment on the load shedding, waiting on the train that is being delayed, what is the effect of that? What have people said about it? Do you want to hear from ENCA what he said about the load shedding crisis? Because I do love this. This is what Ivor Fechter was commenting on, so maybe you have a comment too.
Plays a critical role in the life of South Africa and life of South Africans. So due to the important role that it plays in the economy, its inability to provide electricity on demand and on time is a crisis. I've said as much, and I've said that we should pay due attention to what needs to be done. We've now been hit by a slightly different type of problem where one of the generating sources, Kahora Basa, has been hit by a cyclone. It's a natural disaster, unforeseen. We're concerned about that. And for that reason, we sent out Defense Force units to go and check what's happening in Mozambique and make sure that we put it back in place, because it's important for our economy that we should continue generating electricity.
First of all, I'm really struggling to stay awake during most of Cyril's ramblings, and I mean, I can tell that he's tired on this train and he's maybe just too old to be president. I don't know. Anyone who's over 65 now, I'm starting to think maybe we should be looking at younger leaders. There's wisdom, but you can't keep these old people awake for too long. You know, and I feel like Cyril's just, he sounds so exhausted here. And he's saying the things that are obvious instead of saying the things that we want him to say or that he should be answering. He's saying, well, electricity is important to the economy.
Of course it is.
And of course we need to solve these problems. And I've said it's a crisis. And that we don't want to hear from you that it's a crisis. We want to hear what you're doing about it. And then he says, well, the one is a natural disaster. And frankly, I think South Africans have stopped believing all these excuses that Eskom has thrown up, because every year it's every time
there's something
it's a
new
different excuse.
There's the board, there's the
it's substations
Magoopi,
that have blown up,
yeah,
it's ash that's collecting somewhere, it's coal that isn't the greatest quality. There's always some, and it's always a bullshit excuse. You could see right through it. Now this one has to do with two power lines, which I found out yesterday account for what, 5% of our total power.
Oh wow.
So if we're on the knife's edge where 5% of our total power gets us to level 4 rolling blackouts, that's because your government, President Cyril Ramaphosa, has failed. Failed. So what I'd like you to say is not that it is a crisis, and not to do what you did in another statement where you said that this is our collective fault. It isn't. South Africans didn't go into power stations and sabotage them. Ordinary citizens of this country have not been on the board of Eskom to oversee its decline and total collapse. These are your people, the ANC, your government-deployed cadres. This is why we're experiencing what we are. Be honest about it, and we will treat you with respect in return, Mr. President. But this is unacceptable. And the fact that you were trapped on this train and journalists actually get to ask you these questions is a great convenience for the rest of us who want answers. Unfortunately, you didn't take the opportunity to give us answers. You took the opportunity to find excuses and to just give us platitudes.
I have to be honest and admit that last week's burning platform actually changed my perspective on a very general level.
Yeah.
I was a supporter of Ramaphosa simply because I thought he was just a better option of a president. And I think
than what we had before.
Yes. And yeah. I think after Zuma stepping down, Ramaphosa coming in did steady the country a bit, just in terms of the energy that we had. We were feeling slightly better about ourselves. We were feeling even slightly optimistic. But that is quite a fleeting feeling. We now need things done. You know, we need things properly discussed. We don't just need fluffy
things
said
anymore. The honeymoon's
over. Absolutely. The euphoria is over.
The Ramaphoria is over. It's gone.
Yeah.
And now, you know, just statements like this don't cut it anymore, President. We now see you on a train. You are stuck for 3 hours. Answer to that.
Mm.
And better yet, answer to why countless people in this country have to suffer that every single day.
Absolutely. Spot on. All right, so a couple other things. George W. Bush, the former president of the United States of America, came out in support of immigration. It's obviously a big hot button issue in America at the moment. There are lots of people talking about Trump's wall. There are a lot of people talking about this Mexican invasion. President George W. Bush, who of course lives in the state of Texas now, has quite a lot to say about this, and here's what he said.
America's elected representatives have a duty to regulate who comes in and when. In meeting this responsibility, it helps to remember that America's immigrant history made us who we are. Amid all the complications of policy, may we never forget that immigration is a blessing and a strength. Public debate on the matter is getting pretty sharp. That's not exclusive to this issue.
All right, this sound gets a little bit bad. But he says that immigration is a blessing and a strength. And I think that's true for the United States of America as it is for South Africa. We have so many people in this country who are making a very positive contribution in work, in jobs. I mean, who would disagree with him? You know, we got Zimbabweans out here doing Uber. We got people from all other countries. We've got Congolese people in South Africa. We've got Dutch people, British people, Irish people. We've got people from Malaysia. We've got Filipino people here in South Africa, and they're all contributing. That's why they came here. They came here to make their own way. And I don't think that anyone in the world should be opposed to immigration. The problem is illegal immigration.
Mm.
And that, I think, everyone with a brain understands is a problem. Because if people are just flooding into your country illegally, then they become a burden on the state.
There's no form of control.
Yeah. And they do then displace local people, and they create a whole lot of other demographic troubles. But I think immigration, most of the smart, civilized world understands immigration is what happens when one country is better than another. and people want to go to the better country.
Right.
That's just what happens.
Take it as a compliment.
Right. Just like we, just like we, for example, have to look ourselves in the mirror and say, well, there's a lot of people who are emigrating from South Africa, who are leaving here because they don't like the fact that we don't have consistent electricity, that our government doesn't seem to know whether it's a teapot or a hockey stick, that there aren't as many economic opportunities. And if you're a qualified person, you could probably be paid more elsewhere. That's absolutely fine. And those people must emigrate to a country where they feel there is more opportunity for them. Everybody knows it. But you've got to do it legally. Right, you got to apply, you got to go through the processes.
Fill in all the forms, right, stand in the queues.
And it's a pain, and no one wants to do that. But if you're going to immigrate illegally into a place, then you're going to be caught and you're going to be sent home, and it's very ugly, and it makes a lot of people cry, and it separates children from parents, and it's all very ugly.
Mm.
So I think nobody's going to disagree with George W. here. It's not controversial what he said. It shouldn't be.
It's not controversial, but boy, has his accent deepened since he's been...
You think he's become more Texan?
Oh, my word. So much so.
Really?
Yeah.
You think so?
Elected representatives have a duty...
Representatives
have a duty. Maybe he has become more Texan.
I think he has.
Well, he lives on that ranch in Crawford. No, that's where he spends most of his time. I still think he would have made a great father-in-law for me. If Jenna and Barbara hadn't gone and got married to some losers... I would have been a great father. I would have been a great
son. He would have been a laugh a minute at the dinner table.
I would have got on with him really well.
Especially when he started joking.
You were really into the Bush girls?
No, I wasn't into them. They were both kind of average, but I liked the idea of being George W.'s son-in-law.
I just recently found out about Jenna's wild days.
Yes, they used to throw up in the streets and... got drunk. I mean, come on, look at who their dad is. You know what a nutcase he was? He was like a cokehead and a major alcoholic.
There we go.
He was a badass when he was young.
The two of them released a book, talking about their childhood experience. And it was Barbara who, as a teenager, actually opted to go and study abroad. Mm-hmm. So I think she went to Italy or something. Mm-hmm. So she really wasn't in the public eye much. Jenna, on the other hand,
went crazy. She was hot. She was the blonde one.
Off the rails.
And funnily enough, Jenna's now the one who's a mother and married. And Barbara's the one who's now just, you know.
Well, let's go
life.
From America's royal family to, I don't know if the Bushes are a royal family, but they're up there.
Mm-hmm.
To Meghan Markle and Harry. Leanne has the baby name odds, which I know Sia will be fascinated by. So what do we got? Harry and Meghan's baby name odds.
All right, I'm going to start.
What are they going to
call
the child?
At number 10.
All right. Abu Bakr.
No.
No?
Mary.
Mary.
Mary. Pretty much everyone in the royal family is named Mary.
Mary.
Okay.
Okay.
Queen Elizabeth's grandmother was named Mary.
Mary.
Queen Elizabeth's other middle name besides Alexandra is Mary.
Mary.
Etc. Yes. In number 9 is Grace.
Grace.
Okay. This one just seems to be a nice name.
It is a girl, right? So there's no need to include male names here. All right.
It was ranked number 13 in England and Wales.
Grace.
I had a great grandmother
called Grace.
Sophia. Oh.
Sophia. Yeah.
Or Sophia. And it could be spelt either way with the PH or the F. Not unheard of in the British family, but it's not widely popular there.
Yeah, the one I can think of is Sophia, the Electress of Hanover. Ooh. In 1700 and something. She was probably the last Sophia.
Okay, then we've got Alexandra in 7th.
So that would
as we mentioned, is Queen Elizabeth's one of her middle names.
Great-great-grandmother, right?
That's right, so the name of King Edward the 7th's wife. Yeah. Then we have Elizabeth in number 6.
Elizabeth. Yeah. I wonder where they got that name from.
Oh, hang on. There are boys' names in here.
Yeah, the gender's not confirmed yet.
All right.
Okay, all right. Well, it seems that people have decided that it's going to be a girl because there are more girls.
Yeah, some people have said that they've slipped in the media with certain responses that they've given and they think it's a boy, but we don't know yet.
Okay, because number 5 is James.
James.
James. No,
I think it's too... basic.
I'll tell you why James isn't going to work. The last Jameses in the royal family were Catholics, which is it used to be a bit of a shock horror gasp. But you know, Catholics are excluded from the line of succession.
Oh.
So the last King James was King James II, and he was a Catholic. He died in France, and they called his children the Great Pretender and so on, because they were Catholics. So I don't know that James is a good one to go for. That one was sort of blacklisted.
Mm. I think it's come up because Meghan's great grandfather's name was James.
Sorry about that, but it's not going to work.
Mm. Okay, in fourth place.
Like, nobody knew who your great grandfather was, honey. But we know who the Queen's great 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 grandfather was.
That was 1688.
Slightly more, you know, well bred than the other. Yeah.
Okay, in fourth place is Arthur.
Yeah.
Being used a bunch of times in the royal family. Also one of Prince William's and Prince Louis's middle names.
There was also Charles. Charles is Charles Philip Arthur George.
There you go. In third place, we've got Alice.
Alice?
Alice was the name of Harry's great-grandmother,
Alice.
Princess Alice of Battenberg, who was Prince Philip's mother. Queen Victoria also had a daughter named Alice, and it's been used in the family more than once since then.
Alice is good. All right. Do we like Alice?
No.
No, you don't like Alice.
I just think of Alice in Wonderland.
Yeah, no, it's a story. All right.
Second place, Victoria.
Mm.
Could be used in honor of Prince Harry's great-great-great-grandmother, Queen Victoria, or Posh Spice.
Might as well say Victoria's Secret. Oh, throw that in there.
They are friends and all. Yes. You know?
No. She was at the wedding. Why not? Posh Spice. Why did you call your daughter Victoria, Harry?
Well, Meghan and I were sitting and we sort of decided we'd quite like to call her Victoria after Posh Spice, who's our friend.
We were sat in the pub.
I was sitting with David. David said to me, "Hey, why don't you call your daughter after my wife's name, Victoria? It's a good name, don't you think?" And I said, "Yes, good idea, David. Let's have another pint."
Okay, number one, the first name with the most odds and the best odds, rather.
Yes, is?
Can you guess?
Is this a boy's name or a girl's name? Diana.
Yes, well done, Sia.
And this is all speculation. I highly doubt it's going to happen. Not at all. If it is a girl...
All
right. No, I don't think they'd be that blatant. No, I don't think it will happen.
Well, we'll have to see if it's one of these on the list. I shall bookmark the article.
All right.
If it is a girl, though, I've said this repeatedly, and I'll be consistent with it, I do reckon there will be some sort of nod to Meghan's family. Like, I think, like, the third name will be Meghan's mother's name, Dorian.
Okay.
Mm.
Very good.
But not the principal name that they'll go by.
Well, apparently she's due late April, so we have a month and a bit to wait.
All right.
Yeah, they just call the baby our little bump whenever they refer to it in interviews. So it's not like a
not
he
so
or she.
Not so little anymore.
Oh, it's a big bump.
All right, a few messages. This one is from someone who wants to talk a bit about the protest. And egging is an acceptable form of protest. It's more symbolic than violent. It accomplished what is intended. It brought attention to the bigotry of the senator. The fact that he reacted with violence not equal to the attack says more about him than the kid. The Prime Minister of Australia has sided with the teen and condemned the sentiments of the senator. Well, I got to ask you this, whoever it is, because you didn't put your name into the message. So what do you do if someone throws an egg at you? Or they crack an egg on you? You have things to do after this egging. Now you have to walk around with an egg all over your stuff. I mean, how do you consider that? How about an acceptable form of protest is to ask the senator to chat to you afterwards? You can record the conversation with him. Say to him, "Listen, I have a problem with what you said. Do you mind clarifying your position on this? And do you mind explaining to people why you're so bigoted?" How about that? Because then we can actually get into it. Because that wouldn't have got social media attention. Because what this has become about is it's become about this kid and how brave, in inverted commas, he was. How brave he was to egg in a senator. You know, in the free world, this kind of thing doesn't get you much more than what the senator delivered. Try doing that in Russia. You'd be killed. You'd be put to death. You'd be shot. A million bullets would be riddled through your body if you tried that at Vladimir Putin.
Yeah.
Or on the Ayatollah in Iran.
It also wasn't only the senator's reaction. It was the people around him, who must have been security, who really pinned this teenager down afterwards. And there were five men sitting on top of him.
Yeah, well, good.
And I don't know. I thought it was a little bit, made me feel a bit uneasy.
Yeah, I say it's good. All right, Ryan sent me an email. Ryan says, hey team, what are your thoughts on Trevor Noah having a mini orgasm after meeting the president in the cabinet? Surely he should take a different stance against the government that has caused so much damage instead of boasting about being able to meet the president and it being such a privilege. Well, do you want to hear what Trevor said?
Yeah.
We do have to get to blind history, but let me throw this in quickly. So here's Trevor Noah having a mini orgasm about the meeting with President Ramaphosa and the cabinet. All right. So Trevor talks about this in his show, apparently. Mm. All right. Take it this away anytime now. Anytime, Trevor. That would be nice. Jesus, this thing is taking forever. Mm. Hold on. Here it is. Okay.
Did I do anything fun while I was on vacation? Actually, I did. So I went back home to South Africa. Went to check up on, yeah, it was just fun. I went to check on my, like, the foundation, went to catch up with my people. And it's funny because every time I go home, people always shout at me about going home, which is a weird thing. So, like, I'll get home and then at the border, like, literally at customs, the woman was like, she's like, Trevor, when are you coming home? And I was like, I'm home. She's like, no, but when are you coming home? And I was like, but I'm here right now. You're holding my passport. She's like, no, that doesn't count, Trevor. That doesn't count, Trevor. We miss you. Then I'm like, but it's not like you saw me. Like, it's not like I was just running around in the streets every day. She's like, no, Trevor, come home. I'm like, I'm home. But then what was crazy and amazing was I was in Cape Town. And then my a friend of mine called me and said, yo, Trevor, what are you doing? And I said, I'm waiting, I'm going to go to an event later today. And he's like, oh, because the president wants to meet you. So I was like, the president of what? No, because I just didn't assume that the president, like, I was like, could be like the president of this company, the president of, like, the students association, I don't know. So I'm like, which president? And he's like, the president of the country. Then I was like, what did I do? Like, what did I? He's like, no, he just wants to, like, he wants you to come and say hi. So he wants you to come to, like, to the presidential, you know, the presidential homestead in Cape Town and just come and say hi. I was like, okay. And so then I was with my friends and I was like, guys, come, we got to go do this thing. And my friends were like, all right, let's roll. And then they rolled with me, but I didn't tell them what it was. And I didn't realize in the moment that I didn't tell them what it was. So, like, my friend's, like, wearing a hoodie. My other friend's wearing, like, a free T-shirt. And then I'm wearing a suit because I'm going to another event. And then we get there, and then they're like, what are we here to pick up? And then I say to the person at the counter, I'm like, oh, we're here to see the president. And then my friend's like, dude, I'm wearing a hoodie. And I was like, oh, I'm sorry that I forgot to tell you where we were going. And so then we went in, and then we met the president, and he was just very cool. It was just like, you know, and then my friend, like, he apologized. He's like, I'm so sorry, Mr. President. I did not know I was meeting a president today. That's why I'm dressed like this. And then the president was cool. He's like, no. He's like, I didn't know I was meeting you guys. That's why I dressed like this. And it was cool. He was nice about it. And then, just out of nowhere, the president was like, Trevor, he's like, what are you doing now? He's like, come with me to Parliament. I want to introduce you. So he, like, takes me, you know, to our Congress, and he's like, to Parliament, and he's just like, just come with me. And so he's like, walk with me. And now you're, like, on the president.
Well, I think that is kind of exciting, and I'm happy that Trevor did it, and that sounds like a cool thing. I don't have a problem with that. But Ryan's comment is, let me just carry on with his email for a second. He says, should he not be taking a different stance against government that has caused so much damage instead of boasting about being able to meet the president and it being such a privilege? I think he's underestimating his fame and influence on South African people. I'm slightly disappointed. Well, I don't know. I mean,
I think regardless of which president, what the president's doing at the time, it's a story in itself that you got to hang out
with the president.
The president.
Yeah, sure.
I think part of it is this role model, or rather responsibility someone has labeled that we throw on people. Before as well, they're also just a person who had a cool experience.
Sure.
And, you know, he's not thinking, oh my goodness, well, I have the platform, and what should I say, and what is the right thing?
Criticize him. I mean, also, you're not going to be invited by the president and then suddenly go, oh, Mr. President, by the way, you really fucked up with ESCOM. Because you know how long your meeting with him is going to last? 2.5 seconds? So there's also an element of, like, you've got to be a decent human being about this. You've been invited. You've got to have some manners. And I don't have a problem with Trevor boasting about it or having what you call a mini orgasm, Ryan. I mean, the president, I think, is embarrassed and aware of what the problems are. And I think he's also caught between a rock and a hard place in terms of the support that he has within his own party. I think it was clever of him to leverage Trevor Noah's popularity to try and make him look good. And for Trevor to get the experience, be able to talk about it on American TV is not a bad thing for us. I don't see it as one. Anyway, that's about all we got time for today. We've got to get to Blind History, which is coming up next. Let me just let you know, that's about Jan Smuts. Also got a repeat of an interview with Tim Duplessis, the journalist, coming up next. All of that and more on the way. CliffCentral.com. Don't go anywhere.
This is CliffCentral.com.
When you need a few pages as opposed to a few lines in your epitaph, you must have lived a fairly incredible life. So it was with Jan Smuts, statesman, military leader, philosopher, and polymath. He was the only person to sign both of the peace treaties ending the First and Second World Wars. Like so many people in history, his legacy was controversial, but his contribution enormous. He wrote the draft documents that brought both the League of Nations and United Nations into being. And he was president of our country. We're talking Blind History, and I'm with Anthony Medera, a fellow history geek. We're talking about the Prime Minister of South Africa. He was Prime Minister in 1919 until 1924, and then again from 1939 to 1948, Jan Smuts. So he is a very interesting figure because the thing that drew me to him isn't so much his political or his military relevance and significance, but there's stuff about how brilliant this man's brain was that I had completely overlooked, or maybe I hadn't even been taught when I was younger.
I found him also incredibly interesting, and his philosophy and the book he wrote.
Yeah, he was so clever. He did language and science and was 4 years ahead of his contemporaries in terms of age. He eventually got a scholarship to Cambridge. He didn't have a lot of money because he came from a farming family in the Cape, and money was a big problem for him. But he started writing about what is called holism, which is his own philosophy. He wrote a book called Walter Whitman, The Evolution of Personality. And in it, he starts to develop what is essentially a whole new area of philosophy. And when he was at Cambridge studying, Lord Todd, who was his master at Christ College, said that in 500 years of Cambridge, only three outstanding people had been produced: Milton, Darwin, and Smuts. Well, that's some high praise.
That is massively high praise. And he was on the farm still when he was 12. So that puts it into perspective. 12 years old, still on the farm. His mom taught him to read and write. And at 21 years old, that's what they say about him. Just incredible.
He was praised roundly for his brilliance, just his ability to take to things. He was also a botanist, interestingly enough. He used to collect plants and send them back to the Royal Horticultural Society in England.
Much later on in his life, he was interviewed, and he obviously had countless interviews because he was so well respected. And this one lady was interviewing for the Times, and, "Why, as a general, are you so interested in grasses?" I said, "My dear lady, I am only a general in my spare time." He was quite friendly with Queen Frederica and the King of Greece. How it transpired was they were under massive pressure from Hitler, and so they were going to extradite them and send them to South Africa for a safe place. Him and his wife, Isa, they were very, very friendly and put them up. And after 2 weeks, the king and his brother, Crown Prince Paul, went to England because it was very dangerous in Greece at the time. Mm-hmm. But the king's brother's wife, Frederica, stayed behind, and he did write how beautiful she was. And so his political enemies jumped on that and said, "No, he's having an affair with this young princess." Mm. And Isa didn't blink an eye. But to such an extent, he went to the coronation of Princess Elizabeth. And who was on his arm? At the time, it was now Queen Frederica.
Oh, wow.
Because the king had passed away, and then the brother became king. She became Queen Frederica. Last point on this, interestingly enough, and a big irony, is she was the granddaughter of Kaiser Wilhelm II, and her brothers fought for Hitler in the Second World War.
Sure. Despite all of this English stuff in the beginning of his life, he was fiercely South African. He was fiercely proud of being an Afrikaner South African and fought the British in the First and Second Boer Wars.
Correct, he did do that.
He was incredible. He gave up a really good career in law to come back to South Africa. His dream was always a united South Africa. And he started off working, his first boss was Cecil John Rhodes when he worked for De Beers. And then Rhodes obviously staged the Jameson raid, and Smuts was very pissed off with him and broke with him completely, said, you're on your own. And he then went into politics and decided to become Paul Kruger's eyes and ears.
From there, he stuck with politics the rest of his life. Although, having said that, when he lost the elections, I think it was in 1948, he spent a lot of time on his writings again and on his grasses and his botany.
Mm.
So he does go back to it. But yes, politics was his big love and military strategy.
He was also quite close to Louis Botha. He was his deputy for the longest time, and he was minister of first the interior and mines, then of finance and defense. So he really had a varied and interesting political career as a member of the SAP, the South African Party, which was largely an Afrikaans coalition. But it wasn't as right-wing as the Nationalist Party, which eventually beat him in the 1948 election under Malan. But he has an interesting history in terms of his feelings on what turned into the biggest issue in South African politics, segregation. In the beginning, he thought segregation was a good idea, but later on, he changed his mind. And because of his change in mind, he lost the election to the Nats. If he had stuck with segregation, he might have won that election, and who knows what could have happened then.
So he wasn't trusted in South Africa.
He was much more loved overseas.
He had a conciliatory tone in terms of after the Anglo-Boer War, he wanted to get the English and the Boers together more.
Mm.
And that really upset the Boers. And you can see it play out when they had the vote to see who would go into the Second World War. He narrowly won it and Herzog had to resign. So he had a lot of distrust in South Africa. He was significantly more liberal than the other Afrikaners. And he established the Fagan Commission because the ANC at the time was already established and the Indian Council, etc., were saying, you know, we're absolutely impotent in government in any way to rule our people. And so the Fagan Commission came out with different methods or different reports on what we can do. He said it's absolutely nonsense that two races can live separately. But he knew that this would be the end of him. He knew that also this couldn't persevere in the future. And then he was the Gestichte Nationale Party. He lost the elections then.
You know, what's interesting about him too is that he had this amazing life that overlapped with so many other great lives. So we'll get into Churchill in a minute, but he was also contemporaneous with Gandhi. And he and Gandhi had meetings, and he was very much opposed to what Gandhi was doing. Gandhi was obviously running the movement for equal rights, but he did have time for all of these people at a time where most of the kind of controlling male white ruler class of South Africa didn't even make time to sit down and talk to these guys. And he did when he and Louis Botha eventually wanted to set up the Union of South Africa in 1909. He led the discussions, the kind of commission, and he wanted to have the capital in Pretoria, which he got. He wanted to have English as the official language, which was very strongly opposed. Even though he was a proud Afrikaner, he realized English would be a much better official language for the country to be part of the world. That was opposed very, very stringently by the Free State. They didn't like that at all. And eventually they compromised and the first South African constitution was drafted. We mustn't forget, and you've already hinted at it, that there were members of the Afrikaner nationalist movement who were actually sympathetic to the Nazis in World War II. And wanted South Africa to fight with the Germans, not with the British. And he was obviously very opposed to that.
And a lot of the Afrikaners went up to what was then Southwest Africa and to join up with the Germans. When they declared war on Germany, South Africa declared war on Hitler, and there was a definite split.
So he and Churchill had an interesting relationship. Churchill was known for being very bolshy and very direct and very decisive and didn't want to hear other people's opinions. But Smuts used to stand up to him.
Correct, he did. He was so well respected by all, so many people in the world. But I've got an incident that Lord Mountbatten recalls. And he said it was the only time that Churchill was, in his mind at least, defeated. And it said, at about 1 a.m., Churchill said to the gathering, "Well, gentlemen, now we will start work." "No," said Smuts, "I'm going to not start work. I'm not going to be party to killing your chief of staffs. They have to be back in the office at 9 o'clock in the morning, ready for meetings at 9:30. You will still be lying in bed with a fat cigar dictating to your secretary. They will have to work all morning and all afternoon, and in the afternoon you have your siesta. You bring them down here and make them work all night as well, you will kill them, and I'm not going to be party to that." With that, Smuts got up and went to bed. There was a stunned silence for a minute or two. Nobody spoke. After a long pause, Winston stood up and said, "Well, gentlemen, perhaps we'd better go to bed."
Probably the only recorded time, as you say, that Churchill was defeated.
Yeah.
But if Churchill had died in World War II, do you know that Smuts would have become Prime Minister of the United Kingdom?
I read that. I did. I was aware of that. That's incredible. That's how highly rated he was.
Mm. And apparently King George VI and Queen Mary, who was his mother, were very comfortable with that. They said, yep, we're happy for him to take over should anything happen to Churchill. He was one of seven people in 1945 to have been considered for the Nobel Peace Prize. Did you know that? And he was made Chancellor of Cambridge University as the first non-UK Chancellor in 1948. So he really made a huge impression on people in Britain. He addressed both Houses of Parliament and made a very impressive speech just towards the end of World War II about what should happen next. And we know about his foundation in the League of Nations and the United Nations later on.
He really wanted to make sure that they didn't destroy Germany. Because he'd been in both wars, part of the Treaty of Versailles and of the League of Nations post-war, he realized that a really unhappy resolution could create something hectic, and such as Nazis and Hitler. So he was very strong on bringing Germany back into the fold.
After the defeat of Germany in World War I, they wanted to rename what was Tanganyika and became Tanzania, and Uganda, German East Africa, they wanted to rename it Smutsland, and he said absolutely not and would have none of it. So he died here in South Africa in Doornkloof and Irene, in a house that you can still go and visit. There's a museum there. And he died in 1950, just a couple of days after his 80th birthday.
A lot of people saw him outwardly, if you didn't know him well, that he was quite cold and aloof. But he was actually relaxed and genial, and he loved children, to see a different part of his character, especially as he got older.
Wow, what a guy.
If I could just share something somebody wrote about Jan Smuts on his passing. In all the numerous fields in which he shone, warrior, statesman, philosopher, philanthropist, Jan Smuts commands in his majestic career the admiration of all. There's no personal tragedy in the close of so long and complete a life as this. But his friends, who are left behind to face the unending problems and perils of human existence, feel an overpowering sense of impoverishment and irreparable loss. This sense is also a measure of the gratitude with which we, and lovers of freedom and civilization in every land, salute his memory. Winston Churchill.
Hmm. That's quite a good epitaph. Thanks for listening to this episode of Blind History, brought to you by Taylor Blinds and Shutters.
This is CliffCentral.com.